The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 277.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone to the Rebel Capitalist Show that I've really looked forward to speaking with. She is huge. She's a superstar. In fact, in the Bitcoin community.
I don't know about that, but thank you.
Her name is Caitlin Long. She runs the Avanti Financial Group. Caitlin, welcome to the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Thanks. It's my honor to be on for the first time. Nice to connect with you.
Yeah. So I think probably the least interesting thing about Bitcoin is the price.
That's what I say a lot. Yeah, but boy, that's not what most people talk about these days.
Yeah. I know. Whenever I was just in the gym, and whenever I interview someone for the first time, I listen to a couple of their podcasts just so I can get up to speed on kind of their views. And every single one I popped up, it was just Caitlin. What's the talk about the price and how they're in another bull market or what's the halving going to do to the price? And I'm just like, geez, you've got someone on that's this smart, and you're sitting there talking about the price. So I don't want to go that direction at all. What I would like to do, though, I've got a bunch of questions that might be a little more, sane, for a lack of a better word, but I want to get to those later because I'm extremely concerned right now with what's going on with our liberty and freedom when it comes to what I think is extreme government overreach in the form of many things, not least of which is mandates where governments are literally telling businesses that is illegal for them to serve a portion of Americans. And I just did a whiteboard video on this yesterday, and I think the probability is low. I hope the probability is very low, but I think it's greater than 0% that we go into this type of, I don't want to call it a civil war, but that's the best term that I can really think of. And it's not where people are on the battlefield and, Americans have tanks and they're shooting missiles at each other, but really kind of this guerrilla warfare type of sporadic violence that just continues to increase and increase and increase against Americans that just have different belief systems. We saw this really hit a fever pitch in 2020. And so what I'm trying to think through in my own life is, how does Bitcoin fix this? and I know that sounds, kind of ridiculous because it's such a meme, but I was thinking if the, let's say the people who are in favor of the current political narrative or the people who are calling the shots, pulling the strings, if they say, listen, there's this group of Americans that should not have access to the banking system. They are not worthy of it for whatever reason, because they hold this view, maybe they prioritize freedom over safety. We consider them to be a domestic terrorist, let's say. So in that world, if there's, 20, 30 million people that are being excluded from life because of their belief system, how could they use Bitcoin to navigate and continue to maintain some level of quality of life or standard of living? How could Bitcoin help that? And maybe how could the authorities prevent them from using Bitcoin, maybe transactionally, because they're not plugged into the banking system?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, there already are a lot of people that are debanked that don't have access to bank accounts. And it doesn't have anything to do with Bitcoin. It has everything to do with whether they have the appropriate government-issued ID and can prove their identity and can prove their source of funds. Right. Those are the laws, whether you agree with them or not, they are the laws, and every bank complies with them. So, I've always laughed at how mad people get at the airlines. Think back to when we were all flying and, there'd be long delays and you just get mad at the airlines. And in fact, actually a lot of what caused those delays was the government rules. And I don't think the airlines really communicated that very well. They just, people just directed their ire at the airlines, but in fact, actually, they were just complying with a government mandate. And the same is true of the banks. They do, all banks have to comply with this, with the Bank Secrecy Act and related laws and rules. And so if you can't prove your identity, then you can't get a bank account. Right. And there are people who are using Bitcoin, folks that are not registered with the US government, that are using crypto as a means by which to transact in financial.
How could you obtain the Bitcoin?
That's the interesting part, right? Because FinCEN, the government agency that tracks compliance with the Bank Secrecy Act and anti-money laundering laws, and OFAC, the Office of Foreign Assets Control, sanctions and the like, FinCEN does require every money services business to register with them. Hmm. They don't regulate. There's a misnomer that if you're a registered money services business that you're regulated. No, it just means you have to do the compliance work on that. And so the reality is that any intermediary that is not registered with FinCEN is running criminal risk for the entrepreneurs who run the intermediary. And it used to be that local Bitcoins, you know, when I first got into Bitcoin, that was how you got it. You got it peer-to-peer through local Bitcoins or through a Bitcoin ATM. And you know, now even individuals who are dealing on local Bitcoins are deemed to be money transmitters or virtual asset service providers, to use the phrase in the regulation. And as a result, even an individual who transacts a lot could turn out to be one of those and have to comply with FinCEN.
And that pertains to this local, most recent infrastructure bill, doesn't it?
Well, the infrastructure bill pertained to taxes. Yeah, it is different. It wasn't FinCEN compliance. It was taxes. And that has to do with, if you are transacting a lot of virtual currencies, then you're required, you fall under the definition of broker, and you're required to report a 1099 on the part of your counterparts. Now, all intermediaries, frankly, expected to have to do this. You didn't hear the intermediaries fighting about it. In fact, the intermediaries have been asking for guidance from the IRS about what exactly they want us to report for years. And for a while, the exchanges like Coinbase were sending out tax reporting forms that actually caused more problems than they were worth. Because one of the issues with Bitcoin that's very different than, say, your brokerage account at Schwab or, you know, Robinhood or Merrill Lynch, is that in most cases, people only have one brokerage account. So all their stocks are in that account, and the tax accounting gets done by the broker dealer.
Right.
But you don't have to track your different tax lots because they're all in one place. Whereas with Bitcoin, most people actually don't keep all their Bitcoin in one place, right? We all understand not your keys, not your coins. Or if we don't, we should. There are a lot of new folks to Bitcoin who may not understand that. But it means there's a lot of counterparty risk to keeping your crypto at an exchange. And as a result, most people don't keep it in one place. Most people diversify where their Bitcoins and other cryptos are. And as a result of that, it creates a big tax reconciliation headache. Because you can, and actually the tax laws require you to report your capital gains based on your tax lots. And so if you're buying and selling a lot, you're taking it from your different tax lots, and those tax lots might not actually be in the same place. And so what you get, and this was one of the challenges from tax reporting that happened with Coinbase a couple of years ago, and other exchanges as well. I don't mean to single them out, but they reported transactions to the IRS, but a lot of those transactions may have just been someone moving coins into their own wallet rather than triggering a capital gains tax. And as a result of that, a lot of over-reporting got done, and it caused a lot of problems for those in the industry who were doing their tax reporting. And then the IRS came back and said, no, you didn't do it correctly. And then folks had to go prove to the IRS that they did it correctly. So to come back to your question, the industry has been asking the IRS for guidance. What exactly do you want us to report? Because if we're reporting everything, it may be that somebody's just moving their coins to their own hardware wallet and not actually selling them. And so there's no taxable event in that situation. And so if we're reporting everything as if it were a taxable event, it's way over reporting. And the IRS understands that. But the challenge is, we don't have that information, right? Those of us like Avanti, we're not operating yet, but we're an intermediary who will be doing the tax reporting, and we don't have all that information. We don't know where the coins went, and whether it was a sale or whether it was just merely a transfer to your hardware wallet. And those two examples have hugely different tax consequences. But anyway, long story short, back on the infrastructure bill, the fight wasn't about that. The fight was not about intermediaries, because like I said, we all know we're going to have to be doing tax reporting. The fight was over whether the definition of broker was so broad that node operators, miners, validators, and others that don't have access to the tax reporting information, because they don't know who their counterparties are, they just know a public key address, that's where the issue was. And it came out after the fact that the U.S. Treasury Department really did on purpose very broadly define broker, and what they're looking for is the authority at the agency level to make the determination who has to pay taxes or not, and they wanted to make it future proof, but they did it by making it overly broad. And that's why we had this huge uproar among the crypto industry, because it was an impossible to comply with obligation in a lot of circumstances.
Yeah, but that kind of dovetails or goes back to what I was saying initially, is that it's like the tax code. They make the law so broad, and they do that so anyone that they want to deem a criminal is a criminal, because there's just no way that you could possibly know every single law in the tax code. I always say that if you gave your tax returns, or if you gave your had nine different accountants do your tax returns, you're going to get nine different numbers. So which one is right? And now what you're saying, is the law is so broad that it just casts such a wide net that anybody who they deem, doing something nefarious is going to be caught in that net, and they can take action.
Well, that's not, it's not the law yet. So just because it passed the Senate doesn't mean that it's been enacted, and there are still a number of opportunities to fix it. There's an opportunity to fix it in the House, as we've seen. Apparently it's not going to come up in the House until later this year. So I think this community is going to rev up again to try to get it fixed in the House. And then it could be fixed if the president decides not to sign the bill into law. There will, even before that, there'll be a conference committee between the House and the Senate. It could get fixed then. Biden could say, all right, I want to veto the whole thing. Unlikely, but it's possible he can veto the whole thing and send it back to get fixed if it doesn't get fixed. And then there's going to be a rulemaking process. So one of the things that I've learned getting very deeply involved with the legislative process and the regulatory machine is that there's a public rulemaking process, and those public rulemaking processes are put out for public comment. There will be additional interpretation guidance from the IRS on what exactly it means. The IRS is doing, frankly, what every agency does, which is ask for really broad legislative authority so that they get the interpretive power to interpret their own laws. And then the rules are a lot easier to change over time if the legislation is written broadly. But Congress, as I said at the time, Congress was shirking its responsibility to write laws that are intelligible and to limit the power of the agency. And ultimately, I think this is why you've seen a huge shift in the last 20, 30 years in the United States, where Congress is writing such broad laws and giving the interpretive authority to the regulatory agencies. And that's why the regulatory agencies have so much power. They have more power than elected officials, because they've been granted by Congress the power to interpret these laws that were written so broadly. And that's where the real law is made. Mm-hmm. And Congress can get frustrated that the regulatory agencies are not complying with the laws they wrote, and jerking people around. But the truth of the matter is, it's Congress's fault for writing the laws that way. And it's a function, it's just a failure of the system. where you know the lobbyists line up. I saw Mike Shedlock has Mish had written an analysis of the tax bill. It was $476 million paid by lobbyists for those industries who got in that infrastructure bill a lot of pork. And it's funny because who was it? Somebody was complaining about the $5 million that the crypto industry spends on lobbying. And I just saw those two stories and put the puzzle pieces together. We're not spending enough if $5 million is all we're spending when those other industries spent $476 million. But B, we were just trying to defend ourselves. We weren't you know, eating from the trough or attempting to get all this free money handed out by the government, which is exactly what those other industries that spent $476 million in lobbying money were looking to do. So that's just a failure of the legislative system. But it is a fact that, and we've seen it in so many different ways, that the government agencies are actually a lot more powerful than Congress, and that's Congress's fault. It's a failure of the system.
Yeah, and then we don't elect the government agencies or the individuals that are in the government agencies.
And a lot of the people who have the power to interpret those very broad statutes are not even Senate confirmed. They're, you know, they're career officials. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with Congress writing the laws as broadly as they do, just so that they can hand the power over to the administrative agencies, what else did anyone expect? Of course, this is how the system was going to turn out. Yeah. But that is ultimately, I mean, this is a failure of the US system for sure.
So, okay, those are, I think, crucial points. But I want to go back just for a moment and pretend, okay, I've got $1,000, I've got $10,000, mm-hmm. let's say, but I don't have a bank account. How do I get Bitcoin?
Well, if you're not able to comply with the identity verification requirements and source of funds requirements to get a bank account, you're not going to get it in the United States legally. Yeah. That's the reality, because all of the crypto companies are required to register. In fact, I just tweeted out this morning, Drew Hincus, who's one of the attorneys that is worth following for the regulatory news in the crypto industry. He just announced Florida today announced an amnesty period for crypto companies that had not gotten licensed. And so everyone has to get licensed. Every crypto intermediary has to get licensed. They have to register with FinCEN as what's called a money services business. And then they have to get a money transmitter license from their states. And I retweeted that and almost added some commentary. There are a lot of crypto intermediaries in the United States that are unlicensed. And Florida is giving every one of them an amnesty right now. I suspect other states will do the same. There's a huge regulatory push. I've been commenting on it since April. There's a huge regulatory crackdown happening in this industry. We see it all over the place. And it's not over yet. It's coming. And in fact, actually, if you go back and trace the high of Bitcoin when it hit 64,000 back in mid-April, it was the very day that Tether released its reserve asset allocation. And I saw a lot of the more mainstream fund managers who were getting into Bitcoin at that time, they ran for the hills and said, I'm on the sidelines until this regulatory crackdown comes. And what were they seeing that the crypto folks weren't? A lot of the crypto folks were saying, yay, Tether's got 100% assets backing its liabilities. The more mainstream folks looked at it and said, oh my God, the regulators are going to come after this, because this is not a company that's holding 100% cash against its liabilities. It's
not
a company that's taking a lot of asset risk, right? It's taking interest rate risk and credit risk in its asset portfolio, and it's not capitalized to absorb the losses. When I saw some of the, like, Luke Groman and Grant Williams at the time, privately telling customers and others as well. I don't mean to single them out, but those are examples of the macro analysts that were saying to their customers, whoa, you know, there's a lot of risk here that we didn't know about or had never previously been disclosed. And it's not the risk that a lot of folks were thinking. They were thinking there weren't assets to back the liabilities. It was a different risk. It was, what are those assets?
That's right. I did a whiteboard video on it. It was shocking to me.
Right. Well, and it's interesting because The way that the traditional world thinks about this is different than the way the crypto world thinks about this. The crypto world said, yes, it's great. There's 100% assets there. But the bigger sin isn't fractional reserve banking in the traditional world, right? The traditional world, it happens all the time. Everyone's used to that. The bigger sin is taking the asset risk and not having disclosed it. And that's the kind of thing that they rightfully said, and indeed did occur, that regulators were going to come after this industry. And some will quibble with me and say that wasn't the trigger. If you go back to mid-April, what caused the Bitcoin price to correct? It was other factors like China's mining crackdown, and it was Elon, kicking Bitcoin around. And those two things were absolutely true as well. But I don't think it's a coincidence that Bitcoin's price peaked on the day that Tether released its reserve asset allocation. And then you saw almost for the entire month of June, there were no new Tethers minted. And that just says, a lot of folks were going on the sidelines back then. We're seeing some Tethers minted again in recent weeks, but there was a big hiatus there. And I think that was a lot of the more traditional money that looked at that and said, yeah, regulators aren't going to like that. And it's such a different way of thinking about the world than the traditional crypto world was thinking about it, for sure.
Yeah, I didn't even look at it from a regulatory standpoint. I just looked at it from a standpoint of risk. And I was just like, I would not want there's a lot more to that than it's not like they're. I think people believe that you just give Tether a dollar and they hold that dollar for you and then just give you a digital dollar. But if they take that dollar and then buy Dogecoin as an example, that's a big problem. it's just because they're 100% reserve or whatever. If that asset is something that's extremely volatile, or to your point, has credit risk. That's just as bad, if not worse, than not having full reserve.
It's so interesting because I've had so many conversations with smart folks, including one of my mentors who I've been talking to about economics issues way before Bitcoin. And in the beginning, he thought Bitcoin was crazy and it was just another form of paper money. And then, boy, did he go down the rabbit hole and completely flip. And now he's as hardcore as any of my friends in supporting Bitcoin. But anyway, I'm sharing that background because he and I have regular conversations about why Tether isn't breaking the buck. And so many different issues have arisen. And yet it really, other than that first disclosure of the issues back in 2018, Tether really hasn't broken the buck, not much. And when it does, it has tended to come back. And what does that tell you? There was a very interesting academic paper released by two folks involved with Diem, Facebook Diem, and one of whom is an economist at MIT. I apologize for forgetting the name, but it just came out about 2 weeks ago, and it talked about the asset risk in stablecoins, and how do you prevent the potential for an unwieldy unwind of one of these things? And their theory was that these things trade, stablecoins trade, the reserve-backed stablecoins, I'm not talking about the algorithmic ones, but reserve-backed stablecoins trade at par until they catastrophically don't. And they were very focused on what you're talking about, which is the asset allocation issue. And I was at the time reading that thinking, gosh, this is really that old school thinking. And it's the way the regulators think, no doubt, that the asset allocation matters and there's a lot more risk behind it than we all thought. But my buddy challenges me all the time and says, there's something else going on here. I think because Tether settles so fast, right? It settles in minutes with irreversibility. And as a result, it's the proverbial hot potato. You don't have to hold on to it for very long. You're just transacting with it and you get in and out of it so fast. And what's the probability of an unwieldy unwind in the 10 minutes that you happen to be holding it?
Right.
And that's an interesting way of thinking about it, that financial risk changes because these assets settle so fast that the default risk is actually in a weird way lower than you might think it is, because you can get in and out of them so fast. I don't think that takes the bigger issue off the table, which is that eventually there may very well be a run on a reserve-backed stablecoin. And an example that I can give is, what happens if there's a failure of one of the blockchains? These things are now issued on a dozen or so different blockchains. And the example that I like to give is, we had the alternative, accidental hard fork in Ethereum back in November that lasted for a couple of hours. And if that had not resolved, we would have actually had two different Ethereums. And what would the stablecoin issuers have done? They would have had to have burned the tokens on one of the two chains. They would have had to have figured out which is the one we're going to continue to use and which is the one that we're going to abandon. But the tokens, the stablecoins, would have been on both chains, right? And they only had $1 of reserves to back them. And so we haven't had an example like that, but that's one that's foreseeable, right? We've had accidental hard forks in Bitcoin going back to Bitcoin's early days. I think there have been about a half dozen accidental hard forks. They don't happen once a year, but they do happen every couple years. And what causes an accidental hard fork? It's two miners happening to mine blocks at exactly the same time. That is absolutely statistically foreseeable. And that's one example of how it can happen. And then, you know, the system has to figure out which is the longer chain. And these things tend to write themselves, but what if they don't? We've seen accidental hard forks in other chains that didn't get righted. And then the forks and the chains, you know, you had two chains that accidentally split thereafter and never came back together. And that's the kind of stuff that, you know, the stablecoin industry hasn't faced yet. But these are not black swans. These are white swans. These are foreseeable events with low probabilities, but we haven't faced that yet. And so what if something like that happened and you had to have a sudden redemption of billions of dollars and some of the assets couldn't be liquidated at par and some of the assets couldn't be liquidated quickly? Those are exactly the issues that you know, that a traditional regulator is going to be thinking about, because that's one of the ways that you actually do have potential risk of financial instability leaking into the traditional financial world from the crypto world. Yeah,
right. It's decentralized is better, but it's still messy.
And the stable coins are never going to be decentralized.
Well, I'm talking about this whole process. With Bitcoin, with everything, you know, being decentralized, it's got pros and cons. I would favor it. I think the pros far outweigh the cons. But the bottom line is it's a messy process, very similar to free market capitalism.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
So how does Bitcoin, and I'm going to start with a very generic question, and then hopefully I can hone it down a little bit. But how does Bitcoin go from being a digital reserve asset to money? Towards it's transactional, and we're borrowing Bitcoin. And I'm not talking about I've got 100 Bitcoin and I want to borrow X amount of dollars. I'm talking about I want to buy a new house and the house with is Bitcoin. Denominated in Bitcoin. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. We're not there yet. We're a long ways away from that. And I think what's happening is we're seeing that Bitcoin its use, of course, has its use case has evolved as the network has grown. And in retrospect, that should have been obvious to all of us that it would. It started out as a payment currency and then evolved over time to be a better store of value. So it moved from medium of exchange as a primary use back in, say, 2014. This is when I bought my Christmas presents on Overstock.com with Bitcoin back then. Nobody would do that now. It's too transactionally expensive and for small value transactions. And it's you don't want to hold on. You don't want to spend, it's Gresham's law. You don't want to spend your good money, right? You want to hold on to your good money and spend your bad.
And you definitely, if you're a believer that it's going to go up in price, you definitely don't want to borrow it. You don't want to lend it. You don't want to borrow it. So it's kind of this Mexican standoff.
A little bit, but I do think that that's where I'm going is that it's really useful right now as a base money for high value transactions. That's where its use case is right now. It doesn't make sense to buy a cup of coffee with it because the fees are too high. But here's the punchline. We're going to be building layered money on top of it. And it's Lightning Network.
Okay.
It's sidechains like Liquid. Those are the sorts of things that basically are netting mechanisms that are anchored to the core, to the Bitcoin blockchain itself. And so therefore they are decentralized. They're more centralized than Bitcoin itself, but Bitcoin itself is not really a medium of exchange. And in retrospect, it should have been obvious that it would evolve this way. What's the medium of exchange is Satoshis. And given the cost to transact, you're just not going to buy a cup of coffee with base layer Bitcoin. You're going to buy your cup of coffee with Lightning Network. And that's the sort of thing that I think is going to evolve. And every monetary system, Nick Carter has made this point, and I agree with him. Historically, every monetary system evolved by creating scaling mechanisms that use netting. And the question is, is the netting done by intermediaries that can create fractional reserve claims to the underlying, which is the way the traditional banking system works, or is it done through mechanisms that are anchored to the base layer blockchain,
which is exactly full reserve.
If they're full reserve, exactly. So you're just netting, you're just transacting off chain to save your transaction costs, but you've created a medium of exchange on top of what is your store of value. But Nick Bhatia wrote an interesting book on this that I haven't completely finished yet because it's so good. I just haven't had the time, but I will share it here. It's called Layered Money. Nick Bhatia, Layered Money. Take a look at that because he's a traditional financial services person who's also a hardcore Bitcoiner. And he sees exactly this. We're going to end up building layers, just like every other monetary system built layers. There are layers on top of gold, right? The base money itself is the real physical metal, but we ended up layering warehouse receipts to gold in the 1800s in banks in the United States. It wasn't the gold that actually traded. It was the warehouse receipts that actually traded. Right. And then what happened is you ended up with fractional reserve warehouse receipts. Because there was no way to anchor the warehouse receipts to the actual underlying gold. What's powerful about Lightning is there is a way to anchor the warehouse receipt called Lightning to the underlying network called Bitcoin. And that's the point of Nick's book. We are going to end up building layers on top of it. And whether there are intermediaries that are involved or not, we're going to end up, I think, having a parallel system where there are some that are some intermediaries that are Bitcoin based, like Avanti. Our CTO is Brian Bishop, a longtime Bitcoin Core contributor. And then there will be other non-intermediary based transactions where you can transact as well. But you've got to get into the network most likely through an intermediary. And the intermediary is the gatekeeper. So coming back to your original question, that's where those intermediaries are registered with FinCEN. And it's tough for someone who can't pass the identity requirements
But also in that world where Bitcoin is base money, contrasting it to the gold standard, as an example, like in the 1800s when we had free banking and then we move into central banking. The denomination of what people are trading is still the gold, right?
Exactly.
It's denominating. Yep. So if we move into this world where Bitcoin, let's say, is base money, then the house, in this example, or the car, or the groceries would have to be also denominated in Bitcoin,
or Satoshi's,
or a claim, or a claim on Bitcoin.
Yeah, exactly.
So how do we get there with the current volatility of Bitcoin, and how do we also get there if Bitcoin isn't being lent? Because I think that's a key component of the network growing.
That's where I disagree with you. I'm not a fan of lending. Bitcoin, Satoshi gifted humanity with equity-based money. So why are we piling debt claims on top of it? Part of the problem with the fiat money is that it's credit money. It's debt-based money. And a healthy economy is an equity-based one. If we go back in the United States history, the U.S. was an equity-financed economy until 1968. What do I mean by that? It means all debt borrowed by non-financial sector companies was savings by individuals who didn't who consumed less than they produced, i.e. they saved. And the dollar value of savings equaled the dollar value of non-financial sector debt. So on a net basis, they offset. And what we had was an economy that was equity financed as a whole. Now we used credit money, but up until then it still had a link to gold. Right. And I've always said there's nothing special about gold per se. It was just what tethered the quantity of dollars outstanding. It was just a way to keep a cap on that and not have it grow faster than the total growth in the store of gold that was available. So that's the key is we want to preserve the equity-based money that Bitcoin is. So I'm not a fan of lending. Now, I will qualify this by making the distinction between the same distinction Mises made between credit, circulation credit and commodity credit. That is such a critical point. If you're not familiar with those terms, go dig into Mises and go read about them. Commodity credit is debt that's backed by real savings. Circulation credit is what we would call fractional reserve banking type credit. It's more claims, it's paper claims, more paper claims than there are underlying assets. So Mises was not opposed to debt, and I'm not either. I'm making a critical distinction here that the character of the debt matters. So we could have Bitcoin lending markets that allow you to go up to 1-to-1 loan to collateral ratio. In other words, you can lend up to 100% of the value of your coins. But once you go above 100% of the value of your coins, now you're turning it into a credit-based money. You're turning it into what gold ultimately turned into, where there are more paper claims than there are physical underlying. And what that does is it suppresses the price. So I've not been a fan of all this leverage-based financialization that we've been seeing in Bitcoin. I am not a fan of these 100-to-1 leverage futures markets, or even a lot of the Bitcoin lending that's happening. That is Wall Street bringing old thinking to an equity-based money system. But as I've written, I've been writing about this very topic since 2016. If you're interested, dig into some of my Forbes articles that came out right about the time that backed a subsidiary of ICE, a sister company to the New York Stock Exchange, Bakkt announced that it was going to start listing physical settled Bitcoin futures. And I warned at the time, oh no, here comes the bad financialization, the leverage-based financialization, because Wall Street's going to bring Wall Street thinking into Bitcoin. But here's the punchline on that. Bitcoin gets the last laugh because there's no one who's ever going to make more Bitcoin. And these Wall Street firms are going to get themselves leveraged and over their skis. And there's going to be a run on Bitcoin, and they're not going to be able to find the underlying base collateral that they need to deliver into their leverage contracts. Nobody's making more than 21 million Bitcoins.
Right, and there's not enough velocity.
Exactly. And you know, we're really seeing a shortage of Bitcoin. I follow a couple of interesting folks who track the number of Bitcoins that are available on exchanges. Bitcoin is pretty scarce. And during bull markets, it gets even more scarce, which is part of the reason why the price goes up. Duh, economics work. But a lot of coins get withdrawn off exchanges. During a typical cycle, you'd see maybe 20% of the Bitcoin and Ether owned on intermediaries, held by intermediaries like exchanges or the futures or lending companies, futures, the derivatives platforms and lending companies. But when you see the big price spikes, that plunges down into as low as single digits. There's just not that much collateral, underlying collateral available. And if you had a big intermediary that had a classic run on the bank because they got themselves fractionally reserved and right. suddenly they had to actually deliver the real base layer underlying Bitcoin. That could hit a wall very, very fast and Bitcoin could spike in price. And I have said this as well. I've spent a lot of time in the last couple of years working with mainstream regulators, and I've warned the bank regulators. I've been warning since 2016 that Bitcoin will take down a global systemically important bank, a G-SIB, global systemically important bank. Bitcoin will take one of them down. And it's not because of anything wrong with Bitcoin. It's because of the traditional Wall Street people who have invaded our sector in a big way are bringing the leverage, the circulation credit type of debt into the Bitcoin market. And they're thinking that Bitcoin is just like any other asset. It's not. And we will get the last laugh. The hodlers will get the last laugh when they're desperately trying to find collateral into a market where it just doesn't exist. And yet what they're doing to us right now is suppressing the price. There is no question that when you create artificial claims to an underlying asset, and there are therefore more claims to the underlying than there are real underlying, what does that do? You're just think back to your supply demand curves from your economics class. If you create an artificial supply of something, all else equal, it pushes the price down. And that's what's happening. We are starting to see the Bitcoin price suppression, just like there's been gold price suppression and Dole food stock price suppression. There's a famous case back from 2017 in Delaware where Dole Food ended up having to true up its shareholder ledger because it was acquired and there was a lawsuit. The details are not important. What's important is that what came out is that there were one third more valid claims to Dole Food shares than there were Dole Food shares outstanding. So I'll repeat that. There were one third more people who thought they had valid Dole Food shares and could prove on their brokerage statements that they did than there were actual Dole Food shares when everybody added it up at the end of the day. It's something that that some would refer to as the bezel. There were people selling artificial Dole Food shares, and you couldn't tell by your brokerage statement whether the one you had in your brokerage statement was a legitimate one or whether it was an illegitimate one. But when you added up all the Dole Food shares that people had evidence for in their brokerage statements, it was one third more than the real thing. Okay, what did that do? It meant that real demand was satisfied with artificial supply. And what does that do to your price? It suppresses it. So the way I look at all of this circulation credit craziness that we're seeing in Bitcoin right now, of which I'm very critical, is that this is suppressing the price. And those who are stacking sats, those who are accumulating Bitcoin right now, are getting it at a lower price than it otherwise would have been. And eventually the top's gonna blow because there will be Wall Street firms who have to learn the hard way that Bitcoin isn't like any other asset they've ever dealt with. Some may challenge me and say, well, why is Bitcoin that different from gold? There's a finite supply of that too. And I would agree with that, but here's the difference. Wall Street controls most of the gold in the world. And by Wall Street, I'm talking about all the global banks. Same thing with central banks and the LBMA. Those are banks. They control the underlying collateral. most of the gold is not owned by individuals. The opposite is true with Bitcoin. Most Bitcoin is owned by individuals. Wall Street and intermediaries do not control the vast majority of Bitcoin and never will. It's way too late for that. And that is why I think there will be hard lessons to learn from traditional Wall Street banks. And to be fair, I'm trying to warn them because a lot of their traders want to get in and just start leveraging it and trading it. And I'm trying to warn them and warn the risk folks in particular. This isn't going to end well for you if you think Bitcoin's like any other asset out there. Yeah,
I think it's fascinating that I'm just writing this down. They're creating future demand for Bitcoin that doesn't exist. And it's almost identical to Brent's theory for the dollar going to 130 or 140 on the DXY, Brent Johnson.
I'm not familiar with that. Yeah.
Well, he just talks about the amount of dollar-denominated debt that's outside of the United States. And it's the exact same argument you just made for
Bitcoin. Zero dollars. How
there's just not enough dollars to satisfy the amount of dollar demand. And at some point, because we don't have the velocity, it's going to be time to pay the fiddler. And you're going to see the dollar spike. And that's where, kind of the thesis of the premise of the dollar milkshake theory. And it's very similar to what you're saying with the Bitcoin.
Absolutely. The euro dollar market is what I would call it. Now that you said dollar milkshake theory, I'm familiar with that. And I think they're right. You can be a dollar bear and think that the dollar is not going to survive, right? Historically, all fiat currencies ultimately fail, and it's just a question of when. And so that's not a controversial statement, but the critical thing to understand is that markets can do this before they do this.
That's right.
You can have an unbelievable short squeeze. I think we're going to see an unbelievable short squeeze in Bitcoin. All these Wall Street traders, you look at some of the most famous people in the Bitcoin world, they're celebrated because they're traders. Look at the background of a lot of these folks that came from Goldman Sachs trading desk or, Citadel's trading desk. Okay. So they're thinking that Bitcoin's just another asset class that they can apply their trading strategies to and start piling circulation credit on top of it, start piling paper claims on top of it and trading those paper claims. And they can get away with it for a while. Some have made huge fortunes, some very young folks who haven't experienced, a real short squeeze or a real bear market, piling up lots of wealth, but oh boy, just watch because Bitcoin is, as Trace Mayer likes to refer to it, the apex predator of finance. And the reason is because no one's making more than 21 million and individuals control the vast majority of those. There will never be enough supply for Wall Street type of firms to successfully long-term trade this as if it's any other asset, including gold.
There will never be a repo market where Bitcoin is rehypothecated and there's a 30 collateral multiplier on it.
Well, you know what? There is right now. That's the crazy thing. There are people doing exactly that.
But that's the problem.
Well, this is exactly why it's suppressing the Bitcoin price.
Right.
There's a lot more trading volume that comes into that, right? So it's the same argument I've made with the Bitcoin ETF. That is a double-edged sword. You start getting these Wall Street firms that are rehypothecating paper claims to Bitcoin, right? What does that do?
Some people think they're
buying the real thing. They're not buying the real thing.
Right.
Only if you not your keys, not your coins. If you've got your private keys, then you own the real thing. But there's no question that a number of the coin lending firms are very upfront about it. They rehypothecate Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And so they're
creating artificial supply,
suppressing
the price. Yeah. But at some point in time, they're going to need the underlying asset. That's where you get the short squeeze.
That's right. And I think the reason why the gold market historically has never had that short squeeze that a lot of the gold supporters are predicting is coming, and I would agree with them, it is coming. But the reason why they've been able to, for decades, fend it off is because the banks control the underlying. Again, it's the central banks and the LBMA that control the vast majority of gold. And so for them, it's just a question of allocating it through the clearinghouse amongst each other. But that's not true of Bitcoin. I wrote in a recent Forbes piece, there will probably never be a clearinghouse for Bitcoin. And if you're not a Wall Streeter, you're probably scratching your head and wondering, what does that mean? Why does that matter? And it's exactly what I'm talking about. The central banks and the LBMA are a clearinghouse for gold. And so if somebody gets short unexpectedly, they can go to the clearinghouse and get more because the banks collectively control most of the underlying collateral. But that is not the case in Bitcoin. There will probably never be enough in intermediaries to create a clearinghouse like LBMA for gold. And as a result, it's going to be there are going to be some pretty big failures of traditional financial institutions that have to learn that lesson the hard way. And most of them, even the BIS capital guidelines, the Basel III capital guidelines, they came out and proposed that banks that hold Bitcoin, this is banks that are trading it themselves on their balance sheet, are going to have to finance it one for one with equity. And it's the highest so-called risk weighting for an asset class. And what I said at that time, and this probably shocked a lot of people because I'm a hardcore Bitcoiner, is that's not enough. You saw the banks complaining that it was too high. And I said, no, it's not enough. And the reason is that the capital rules for banks are all very focused on price volatility and not focused on what you and I just talked about for the last several minutes, which is that there's settlement risk. And most of the other assets, really all of the other assets that the big banks trade, have clearinghouses. They can, if they get short, and they need to go get the real collateral to deliver it into their short, they can just go to the clearinghouse and get it from each other. But you can't do that in Bitcoin. That's the difference. And so it really, a fractional reserve bank has no business trading Bitcoin. These crypto assets are truly different animals. And they need to be, to the extent that there are banks like Avanti that touch them, they should be in a straitjacket like the Wyoming digital asset bank rules that say you can't lever, you've got to hold 100% reserves, preferably in cash or T-bills against your customers' deposits. And in Wyoming, at least, we're going to let you keep legal title to the assets by treating it as what's called a bailment under the law. It's very similar to, it's actually the same as a valet parking arrangement for your car or a coat check. You're not handing legal title to your car or your coat over to the garage or the coat check. Rather, you're just handing temporary possession of your property for safekeeping. It's the way the gold money warehouses used to work.
Unlike when you give your dollars to a bank.
Yeah, one of my friends pointed out, when you give your dollars to a bank or your securities to your brokerage firm, using the analogy of valet parking, they take your car, they rent it out to an Uber driver.
No, but they own your car. All the funds. They own your car.
You're absolutely
right. Your dollars. Yeah, yep. They own your car.
And they're making money off your car while they're sticking you with risks you don't even know you have. And then they may give you back your same make and model on demand if you're lucky. But yeah, you won't get your actual car back, right? The difference in the way that Wyoming law is applied to Bitcoin for intermediaries like Avanti and other, there are now four Wyoming special purpose depository institutions just for this, just for digital assets. And again, not your keys, not your coins. I'm not recommending that people hold digital assets with a custodian, but there are certain types of firms that have to. So that's why we exist. So 40 Act mutual funds, your pension fund, they all have to hold assets in a custodian. And that's why these banks exist, despite the fact that I'm a big believer in not your keys, not your coins. But anyway, you the whole idea is you're not giving up legal title to your asset. You're just giving temporary possession and you get it back when you demand it. And so the whole idea of these special purpose banks is they're set up exactly for this. They're not permitted to rehypothecate. And if you're holding dollar assets, they're backing your dollar assets with 100% cash or T-bills. They're not taking the interest rate or credit risk that we talked about some of the stablecoin issuers are taking. This is important stuff. And yeah, I think, once we're finally able to open, we're all still waiting for approval from the Fed. Once we're finally able to open, it's going to be very interesting to see how the market reacts. Would you rather keep your crypto with one of the big banks where when you deposit it, it becomes their asset and they can turn around and make money off it and then maybe give it back to you. And if they can't give it back to you because there's a bank run that happened in the meantime, or, you know, it becomes a Lehman type situation, then, you know, you're in line with the creditors and you're going through a bankruptcy, you know, for a few years, right? We're seeing that, for example, right now with Cred, one of the crypto lenders, which filed for Chapter 11 in Delaware in December of 2020 or 2019. I can't remember what year, but anyway, so, there may be some hard learned lessons. Would you rather hold your Bitcoin in an institution like that? Or would you rather hold your Bitcoin in a Wyoming bank that has these special bailment protections? Or more preferably, would you rather teach yourself, make an investment in yourself in how you securely store your Bitcoin yourself? And make sure that if something, God forbid, happens to you, that someone knows how to find your Bitcoin so they're not lost forever. Those kinds of things are investments in yourself. And I would encourage everyone to make those until you really make those, you're not a true Bitcoiner. A lot of folks, I think, are just dipping their toes in for price speculation.
Right.
But once they go down the rabbit hole, you know, you got to really dig in and learn how to securely store your own private keys.
Caitlin, I've got about 450 more questions for you. And I know we're way, way, way past time. I'll have to save those questions for the next time we have the opportunity to speak.
Fantastic.
For my viewers and listeners who want to find out more about what you do, where can they go check it out?
Twitter's probably the best place, Twitter and LinkedIn. And then avantibank.com, not operating yet. We don't have a launch date target yet. We will announce that, and hopefully that'll be big news when it finally comes.
Awesome. Fascinating conversation, Caitlin. I can't wait to
thank you. Likewise. Take care. Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Hi guys. I'd like to invite each and every one of you to the next Rebel Capitalist Live event. If you are a fan of the Rebel Capitalist show, I guarantee you will love the live event. The next one is Houston, where you can meet and listen to speakers, all your favorites from the Rebel Capitalist show. People such as Dr. Ron Paul, Chris Cole, Lynn Alden, Luke Groman, just to name a few. If you want to check out the rest of the speaker list and find out how you can attend, we'll put a link in the description below, or you can just go to rebelcapitalistlive.com. This is an event where you can learn to build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. But it's not just about building wealth. It's about increasing your freedom and networking with like-minded individuals, fellow rebel capitalists. It's an amazing event. I know you'll absolutely love it. Check out rebelcapitalistlive.com, and I will see you in Houston.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.